Thank you very much. Well, I hope to be continuing one of Thomas's important themes of the dividing line between pagan and Christian, but I must admit I'm doing it in a slightly different way, and that I haven't got such a close, cogently argued paper that Thomas produced, but something rather more informal, that's often raising questions which I'm not necessarily tempting to answer, but I tried to deliberately frame it to bring out wider issues. And although I concentrate on the Anglo-Saxons, I'm hoping to ask as I go, how typical are the Anglo-Saxons of what is happening elsewhere, particularly in Northern Europe? I should say to those people who've had the dubious benefit of a pre-circulated paper from me that I'm taking some parts of it in a slightly different order, although it should contain the same types of things. Well, one of the advantage Anglo-Saxon scholars have is that they have got a narrative of the conversion and how it took place. Of course, it's not an entirely unproblematical narrative, but nevertheless, it does make a huge difference, particularly contrasted to the conversion of Ireland, where the fact that we don't know how individual kingdoms or groupings of peoples, the exact circumstances in which they came to adopt Christianity, the arguments that were used, these types of things. It makes a great difference between how the history of conversion of the two areas has been written. But of course, the Anglo-Saxon experience of conversion must draw a lot on what happened in Ireland because of the importance that Irish missionaries had not only in England but also in northern Francia, where so much of the inspiration for the conversion of the Anglo-Saxons came from. So an interesting question is, when we're looking at the conversion of the Anglo-Saxons and some of the issues about the dividing line between pagan and Christian and how some pagan aspects cross over that line, we may be already looking at what compromises that were made in Ireland that have influenced what's happened in England. So that's something one would like to think about. And some people have rightly been very sceptical of the way that the Anglo-Saxon conversion is presented by Bede and other writers like Stephen. And of course, there is a tendency by these earliest Anglo-Saxon Christian writers to present paganism as Christianity's evil twin, or to mould it round unacceptable religious practices in the Old Testament. And this is likely to have obscured some of the range of paganism, the many variants of pagan practice that took place in Anglo-Saxon England, and perhaps obscured some of the differences between paganism and Christianity, how they functioned as religions. There's this tendency to pair the black and the white. This has led to perhaps too much assumption that they are similar types of religious practice. A writer like Stephen is much easier to use than Bede, because Stephen is a rather unsubtle writer in many ways, and it's very clear where the Old Testament origins are of some of his presentation of pagan practices, and does raise issues of whether he really knows much about paganism at all. And of course, the same has been said of Bede, but this is much more difficult. Bede is a much more subtle and layered writer in what he does, and so there's much more possibility of debate. Just as one example of this, and I'm sorry I haven't provided the text, but I didn't want to, I wouldn't have time if I got bogged down in going through individual texts. Not that I'm suggesting that Thomas did that, because he's extremely useful in the way that he did it, but I'm trying to do something broader. Anyway, the famous description, Ecclesiastical History 2:13, of Coifi, the Northumbrian priest of Edwin, and the destruction of the temple at Godmingham. And on the one hand, we have John Blair looking at the description of the shrine and the enclosures that Coifi destroys, and seeing there a reflection of archaeological evidence, so that seemingly this support to be doing something that's quite realistic. Or we have, on the other hand, the critiques of this passage by Ray Page and Richard North, which suggests that this is largely a literary construct serving various functions in Bede's account, and raised the question of whether Coifi was really a real person at all, whether he was in presenting him as a pontifex and the chief of priests. Bede is really presenting him as a mirror negative image of Paulinus, better to make the idea of the contrast between them. And this passage has been very important, of course, because of the issue of whether there was a noble priestly caste as there was in Ireland. And it's an interesting question about this, and of course also the issue of what one presumes has happened in Ireland, that nobly priestly caste has been incorporated in the Christian priesthood. Is this something that's happened in Anglo-Saxon England as well? And I particularly like James Campbell's recent suggestion on this, that Bede himself may come from one of these families, and that's why he knows so much about the pagan year, that traditionally Bede's family may have been of the priestly caste of the Saxons. So I don't wish to say that there are no problems with the Anglo-Saxon sources. Undoubtedly there are. So where is the dividing line between pagan and Christian? Well, obviously the very simple example, answer to this, is that it's baptism. On the one hand, you have people who are baptized, and these are clearly Christians. On the other, you have people who are not, and they are clearly pagans. So that Boniface, for instance, when talking about his work in Europe, draws a distinction between the Pagani that he works among, like Frisians and Saxons, who've not been introduced to Christianity, and other people like those of Thuringia and Hesse, who are in theory Christians, but are ignorant and are bad Christians. But he sees them as two distinct problems that he has to deal with. But of course, matters are not as simple as that. And Bede, via using Gregory of Great, introduces what I think is a very useful way of thinking about the conversion and of the relationship of Christianity and paganism, and that is the idea of the stepped approach to conversion, that it doesn't take place as one single incident, but is conversion by increments, as it were. Now, of course, Bede often does record a conversion moment, or often in many kingdoms a series of moments, in which he sees significant decisions are taken to take Christianity on board. But the fact that in most kingdoms he in fact shows a series of moments is in fact evidence for this idea of conversion by increments rather than one simple straightforward event. And this, of course, was part of Gregory the Great's strategy, as discussed by Flora Spiegel in Anglo-Saxon England 2007. He advocated at first the Anglo-Saxons were to be brought to the level of the Old Testament Jews with the concept of a single deity, and then they were to be introduced to more complex Christian concepts like original sin, the Trinity, the life of Christ. So Gregory, once he finds out a bit more about the Anglo-Saxons, realises that they're so far down the road of religious practice that it's not possible for them to move immediately from what we might call paganism to being full Christians. It's going to be a different process. It's going to be a stepped process. And, of course, he also stresses the need to establish common ground with compatible existing religious practices. And he is, of course, a great advocate of diversity within unity. There are some things, of course, which every Christian must accept, but there are aspects in how Christianity is practiced that can be varied, and this laid open a way for adoption to Anglo-Saxon practice. So in talking about the conversion of the Anglo-Saxons and other people, I think it's very useful to bear in mind this stepped approach, because what it means, of course, for relationship of Christianity and paganism, that there's going to be certain aspects of paganism that are completely out at a very early stage, but others where there's room for compromise. And there are other ways that we can think about this as well. One could consider, for instance, Berkeley's classical study of conversion in Norway, where he suggested three key phases were infiltration, mission, and institution. And an infiltration phase is often not considered so fully as part of the Anglo-Saxon conversion as it is for the Scandinavian, but I think it's in fact one that should be considered. And this is where, of course, Bede is misleading us. Everything starts with Bede in 597, but if one looks more broadly, one can see that there is a very extensive infiltration phase, and that must affect the Anglo-Saxons' knowledge of Christianity and acceptance of it. And one also must realise that when one's talking about the Anglo-Saxon, I mean, I'm using that term generally, but many of the people who were living with Anglo-Saxons in the areas that we call Anglo-Saxons were, of course, British. And that in the infiltration of knowledge, there is the possibility of British Christianity coming in, but also late Romani British paganism. So one should not assume that there is just one type of Germanic paganism in the Anglo-Saxon areas. It's much more complicated than that. I particularly like the stages of conversion that have been discussed by Ludo Milli in various publications of where he considers the common features of the conversion of Northern Germanic peoples. And he points out in these stages that the first one is to introduce new forms of collective public behaviour, which involves on the one hand baptism and on the other the suppression of older cults. Then secondly, there is the introduction of new moral codes in public life that reflect Christian values. And his third stage, probably never fully completed, is to change individual inner behaviour through the interiorisation of Christian moral code, something he suggests is a very long process indeed, that he would see developing after 1215 and the Fourth Lateran Council as being an important stage in developing that. And I think there are very important matters here, and particularly thinking about the public practice of religion and the private practice and the distinction between those. I think this works for thinking about Christianity. I think it works for thinking about Germanic paganism and, of course, for Roman religion as well. There are certain types of religious practice which are a coming together of people and establishment of their group identity. And these would happen in Anglo-Saxon England, both at kingdom level, but also at the level of lesser groupings that we know existed within kingdoms. And we can expect that before conversion, there were various public rituals in which the gods were a significant element, or that they were not but these were not necessarily assemblies just for religious matters, but assemblies that would take place under the protections of the gods. And as kingship developed, which is a relatively late development in the 6th century, it seems likely from the type of evidence we have, particularly the archaeological evidence for sites like Yevering, that the evolution of kingship involved a manipulation of cult to aid relationship between, on the one hand, the king and his comitatus, and on the other, over the people who he was imposing his will. So I think that's a useful way to think about the conversion of Anglo-Saxon England what it means, and it's part of this idea that there are some aspects of paganism that have to be moved on straight away, but others which are not so significant. But of course, for people, they were very important. There's the private side of pagan, what went on in people's homes, how they dealt with the problems of daily life. These are a different level of concerns from the public activity and the public gods, which have got to be the first target. So the first stage of drawing the dividing line between pagan and Christian is baptism and the rejection of the gods. These two things clearly have got to go in hand. As Bede said in 213 of the decision of King Edwin, he accepted the gospel Paulinus preached, renounced idolatry, and confessed his faith in Christ. You have three important stages here. The education by Paulinus, which, as Gregory the Great has suggested, may not have to go into huge amounts of detail on all the complexities of Christianity. The renouncing of idolatry and the confession of faith. And we see this sort of thing happening in the old Saxon baptismal formula, which may well reflect Anglo-Saxon practice. It's written in old Saxon dialect, but apparently with Old English orthography, and suggested by D.H. Green that it was introduced by Anglo-Saxon missionaries who were working in the Old Saxon areas, but probably based on something that had already happened in Anglo-Saxon England. And in this, people have to state that they reject the diaboli, who in one version are defined as Woden, Thunor, and Saxniath, and on the other, that they accept belief in the Christian Trinity. So we know three divinities, in one in Christianity. And I think here also some of those brachias that seem to have three gods on them. Interesting, this three is already significant. The gods and other supernatural beings could be associated with the devil, so they could, many of them could still exist, but in a slightly different way. But if they see not, they don't all go to the devil, but there were sufficiently bad ones around that they fitted in very nicely. With that side of things. There's some further musing one can do of this. I think Saxniath is an interesting inclusion here. He's not part of the wider Germanic pantheon. He is an embodiment of the Saxon people. So potentially a different category of god, perhaps, from Thunor and Woden, and a reminder that the North Sea Germanic paganism, the area from which Anglo-Saxons came, is not just going to be the same as what's happening in parts of Scandinavia. There are going to be areas that are or similarities, not identically the same. And particularly, we know Saxon appears in the East Saxon genealogy, but other genealogies have got equivalent figures, like Yewis in the West Saxon, Bernich in the Bernician. In other words, this idea of the kingdom as a community under the protection of a particular god is something that may be very important in the development of kingship and the way that the kings are manipulating cultures as it is. This may be a sign of this. And it's carried forward in Bede's emphasis on the equivalence of bishopric and kingdom. This idea of a unity of a people under one god. So, for instance, Bede is extremely indignant when the Dukes of Hampshire and the Isle of Wight, whom he regarded as a separate gens, a distinct gens, were denied their own bishop by the West Saxons. He thought this was wrong. And if one asks when does a kingdom become baptised for Bede, Bede seems to account from the date that a functioning bishopric was established. I know there are setbacks in a few cases, but I think this is when he begins to count a kingdom as being baptised. And of course, only with a bishop in place could a permanent church structure be set up